I'm Theo Greenlee, a reporter with the Alaska Desk. That's a joint reporting effort from Alaska Public Media and KUCB, where I work in on Alaska, and other public radio stations in Anchorage, Fairbanks, Haines, and the Aleutians. It allows us to connect you with the issues happening in communities all across the state. You can hear our stories during the morning news, Alaska News Nightly, or online at alaskapublic.org. The Alaska Desk is only possible with the support of grants and listeners like you. Thank you.
Welcome to Line One, your health connection. I'm your host, Dr. Justin Clark. On today's program, we will be discussing chronic and complex spine pain, one of the most common, yet most misunderstood, health challenges people face today. If you or someone you care about lives with persistent spine pain, you know it's far more than a physical issue. It affects sleep, work, relationships, mood, and the ability to enjoy daily life. Our goal in this program is to bring clarity, compassion, and credible information to a topic that's often overwhelming. We will explore what the latest science tells us about how spine pain develops, why it can linger, and what treatment options are showing real promise, from medical interventions to lifestyle approaches. Whether you're newly diagnosed, managing long-term symptoms, or simply curious about how the spine influences overall health, this show is designed to support your journey. Chronic pain can feel isolating, but you're not alone. Today, I am grateful to have Dr. Sola Olamakin and PA Ivy Weekland with us today from the Advanced Pain Centers of Alaska. Dr. Olamakin, welcome back to Line One.
Thank you, Dr. Clark. It was a pleasure the last time. I'm looking forward to doing this again.
Yeah, I was trying to, I should have looked back exactly, but it's been a couple years since we had you on. We talked about headaches, I believe.
Yeah, it's been about that long. That's right.
Yeah. And so this time we want to discuss chronic and complex spine pain, was something that you deal with on a daily basis in your practice. But for our listeners who have not met you before, would you mind giving us a little bit of background and your training, how you came to Alaska, that sort of thing?
So I did medical school in Texas at Baylor College of Medicine. Great, great experience. Very intense training program at the Houston Medical Center. And then from there, I did my internship in Houston in family practice. So that gave me a broad beginning. I realized I was probably more of a specialist, clarified that for me. And then I went into anesthesiology in New York, did that. I did a PEDS anesthesia fellowship in Colorado in the Anschutz Medical Center in Denver. And then I did a pain medicine fellowship, a second fellowship, which I started in New Mexico and then finished off at University of Washington in Seattle. While I was in Seattle, I had the fortune of rotating with Dr. Stinson at the Advanced Pain Centers here in Alaska, and that's where I discovered like Alaska was wonderful. I had to come back someday. So I went and I did a bunch of I did pediatric anesthesia, pediatric pain in Texas at the University of Texas. I did a bunch of other things in there when I was good and strong. I moved to Alaska and ultimately ended up at Advanced Pain Centers of Alaska with Dr. Stinson. And that's where I've been. This is where I've been ever since. I still do anesthesia, which actually works really well with the pain practice. It keeps me rounded. It keeps me focused. So I'm still doing all of those things, fortunately, as much as I can.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Quite a varied experience. All over the country, too. I mean, Texas, New York, Colorado, Washington,
yeah.
Alaska. You've experienced all the weathers.
All the weathers, all the people, all the different kinds of people that make this country the wonderful country that it is. You know, which is nice because Alaska has, you know, in New York you have New Yorkers, in Texas you have Texans, in Alaska you have everyone. So there's a good mix of all of those people here, and it's nice that I can relate and understand them and apply a lot of that beyond the medical training, just dealing with people here.
Absolutely. And Ivy Weekland is with us as well, a PA at the practice. Mm-hmm. I'll give you the opportunity to tell the listeners a little bit about yourself. We'll mention that about 5 years ago, Ivy worked in my office as a PA doing some medical weight loss management. That was during the peak of COVID.
Yep.
A lot of telemedicine, a lot of fluctuations. And since working for us, you've had a variety of different experiences, and now with Alaska Pain.
Yeah, that's right. You know, that's one of the beauties of being a PA is we can jump from specialty to specialty and really get a broad range of experience in the different fields. And yeah, so I'm originally from Oregon. That's where I was born and raised. I went to Oregon Institute of Technology to get my sonography degree. The fourth year is an externship, and the way that they determine where you go is they put the students' names in one bucket and the locations in the other, and they literally grab a name and a location and you go.
So, oh my gosh.
Yes. So 22 of the 24 sites were in Oregon, two were out of state, one being Anchorage, Alaska, the other being Los Angeles, and I just so happened to get Alaska. And at the time, it was terrifying. My daughter was 6 weeks old, and it just sounded like a foreign country to me. I had never been. But we packed up the vehicle and drove up to Alaska, and I've been here ever since. Fell in love with it. So prior to being a PA, I was a sonographer, worked at Providence and Alaska Native Medical Center. And then in 2014, decided to go to PA school through the University of Washington. And after graduating, I was able to go into primary care, women's health, bariatrics, and then jumped over to pain management. And I've been with Dr. Lamakin at Advanced Pain for, gosh, 2.5 years now, I believe.
Yeah, about so that.
It's
Seems
been
like
great.
Yesterday.
Yeah, yeah. It's been amazing. And, you know, I was able to utilize some of the skills that I learned in bariatrics and incorporate them into our practice. A lot of our patients struggle with obesity as well. Mm-hmm. It's part of the cycle with chronic pain. And we've been able to manage some weight loss for our patients, which has been great.
Yeah, yeah, and we'll talk about that as part of the, you know, treatment regimen here.
Yeah.
So, yeah, pardon me. Yeah, a lot of people get up to Alaska in these weird sort of ways, you know, whether it's military or not. And
yeah.
I think it's not on a lot of people's radar until you get here and realize, wow, it's pretty magical place.
It's pretty amazing, yeah.
Yeah,
yeah. It's hard to leave, and it seems to suck people right back in if they try to leave, so.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, let's get into the topic a little bit. When we're going to start, whenever we talk about abnormal, I always enjoy starting with normal, okay? So what is the normal shape, the normal function of the spine before we start talking about what can go wrong? So, Dr. O, what's your general description of what a normal spine looks like?
So the normal shape of the spine will start from the base of the skull and go all the way to the coccyx. It's got a number of parts, the neck part, the chest part, the belly part, and the below hip part. So that'll be cervical, thoracic, lumbar, sacral. Then at the very end in humans, we have a short coccyx, which in other animals would be much longer, would form the tail. The spine is normally described as having an S shape. There is a curve at the neck and at the low back, which are both inward, and then at the thorax and the sacral part, it's an outward curve. So when you look at the spine from the side, it's a curve, an S-shaped type curve. What does the spine do? The spine specifically refers to the bone and the cartilage parts of it and the disc. So it supports the body. The spine is the anchor, it's the hanger for which the whole body hangs off. You have the shoulder girdles, which hold the upper arms. You have the hip girdles, which hold the legs. And then what the spine does is it gives you your whole body support, and everything hangs off that. It's used for movement. The muscles interact with the spine to move it. It's flexibility. It's within the spine is a hole that goes all the way from the brain all the way down to the end, and this holds the spinal cord or the spinal column, which are the nerves from the brain to the body that innervate and carry sensory, which is feeling, and motor, which is motion, nerves function. The spine also does a lot of shock absorbing. In between each bone, there is a disc. From the neck to about the sacrum. At the sacrum, you don't have disc, and the coccyx, they're definitely none. But these act as shock absorbers as you move through the world so that each step you take does not cause a whole body jarring. It's also function. Another function it does is breathing, actually, because the ribs hang off the spine. So as one breathes and the diaphragm moves, the ribs also move to facilitate breathing. So that's the structure, that's the function of the spinal column.
That's great. So that serve as a good reference for when things do go wrong with the spine and how they can go wrong with the spine. So Ivy, when we start talking about pain, there's acute versus chronic. And obviously today we're geared a little bit more towards chronic, but I think it's important for our listeners to understand what differentiates acute and chronic pain. So are there specific definitions that you utilize in the practice?
Yeah, so, you know, typically when we use the word chronic, chronic spine pain, we typically think about long-lasting pain, pain that generally lasts for 3 months or longer, usually years. Usually it's linked to ongoing conditions, while acute spine pain is short-term, usually days to weeks, usually triggered by, you know, a sudden injury or strain. Typically, acute pain, like I said, is often caused by a specific event or injury, such as lifting something heavy, falling, twisting awkwardly, or a muscle strain, whereas chronic pain develops gradually and is linked to underlying conditions like arthritis, degenerative disc disease, herniated discs, and whatnot. You know, as far as symptoms go, usually with acute pain, we're seeing sharp stabbing or localized pain, muscle spasms, stiffness, and difficulty moving. Chronic pain, we look for more of a dull, aching, radiating pain, decreased range of motion, stiffness, sleep disturbances, and fatigue. So that's generally how they present. We at Advanced Pain Center, we treat the majority of chronic pain. But again, we do have acute pain patients, and a lot of our chronic pain patients will develop acute pain and other injuries as well.
Sure, sure. So, you know, as a 46-year-old weekend warrior, you know, when I'm shoveling snow or being a little over-aggressive with my yard work or exercise, I will, you know, strain my back or, you know, put my back out or whatever you want to call it. And so if that's a couple of days, a couple of weeks of pain and it goes away with rest, then we're talking more of acute minor stuff.
Right, yes.
But then it can turn into a, you know, a longer, more chronic syndrome. So I guess why do some people heal injuries quickly, whereas others might lead to more long-lasting symptoms? Yeah, Dr. Alamagan.
You know, part of this has to do with the tissues involved in the injury and also the way in which the injury is managed. If I'm taking this on from what our prior conversation about acute and chronic pain, one definition of acute pain is like you described, one quality of acute pain is like you described, you're shoveling and you injure and you have pain. Usually that is related to an actual tissue injury, tissue strain. A lot of times chronic pain is no longer related to direct tissue injury that is occurring at the time, but it is a continuation of the process that was started with the acute pain. And so the process just continues. And even though there's not ongoing damage, there is still ongoing pain. And we'll get into this as we continue the conversation. So now when you're looking at why some things heal and others don't, sometimes it is that things heal and others don't. Other times it is the healing is no longer happening. The long-term pain you have is more as a consequence of ongoing sensitization and ongoing kind of a miscommunication of pain signals. So you injure, say, your back. In that process, it irritated a nerve. Now you have a nerve that's irritated, and that pain continues for the long term. The back itself is no longer injured. You're no longer shoveling. You stopped that because it was so painful. You stopped that and said, maybe I should buy a snowblower. So you got a snowblower and didn't continue shoveling, right? But the pain continues long term. So that's part of the picture that we're looking at. Other times, it has to do with the, so there's the nerve involvement. Other times, it has to do with the tissue that's injured. Muscles heal really well. Bones heal beautifully, right? You have surgery, you fix the bone, you give it time, it corrects. You have other things like ligaments or discs that don't heal as well. Anyone who's injured an ACL or a meniscus. And a lot of this has to do with the amount of blood flow that these tissues receive. When they get good blood flow, they get a lot of healing factors come in. They facilitate quick healing. You don't have good blood flow because the body is not made to have good blood flow in those places. Or you have habits that affect blood flow, such as smoking. Then you compromise the ability to heal. So then those spine injuries and those types of injuries would take longer to heal and have more likely to have long-lasting symptoms. Sometimes it's a patient. There's 8 billion people on Earth. We understand most of them. And by that, I mean there are specifics about certain people or whatever their presentation is that would cause them to not be able to heal as well as others. And we see these in our practice. We have, and you know, part of the training of medical practice for this is to try and identify these people and have treatment algorithms that we would use for them. Mm-hmm. Also aging, wear and tear. When you're young, as you probably know with your children bounce. Don't drop them though, but they bounce. They do really well. They come back and they do well. You drop an 80-year-old, you got problems on your hands. So sometimes it's just the fact that you're dealing with tissue that is older, more debilitated, has been through more life, and it just takes a longer time to heal. And a lot of times you just got to give it more time and more focused attention to get it to where it needs to be.
Sure. Ivy, is there some risk factors that you look at when you're determining how well someone can heal? You know, blood supply, you mentioned mm-hmm. blood supply is good to muscles and bones, but bad to ligaments and cushion.
Yeah, absolutely. Kind of along what Dr. Lomkin was saying, you know, our patients who are diabetic or are smokers, you know, oftentimes they take a little bit longer to heal the tissues. They're not getting as great of an oxygen supply to the tissues, and we see a longer time to heal. So I would say, you know, our elderly patients, those who have chronic inflammations with, you know, underlying autoimmune disease or inflammation that's already present, you know, that can certainly affect their healing time.
Sure. So weight is a big issue. Excess pressure on the joints.
Yes, absolutely.
Yep. Diabetes, smoking. Smoking definitely can decrease the blood flow to those smaller vessels, right?
Right.
Yeah. You know, a lot of times it's even just things that are patient specific. How active is that patient, right? Mm-hmm. What is their lifestyle? Also, what do they believe about their pathology and how well they will do and how well they'll heal? There's a very careful distinction we make between, I'll have patients who'll come in and they'll say, no one believes my pain. I say, I believe your pain. Mm-hmm. But at this point, what we have to do is go beyond your experience of pain and start looking at how you're functioning. And so then you're dealing with reestablishing, modifying the relationship of the patient to the pain. And when we can do that well with the patient, we have a lot better outcome for the patients in the long and the short run.
Okay. Yeah. So it's not always about getting rid of pain, although that's the ultimate goal,
right.
But it's about also managing the pain that somebody has.
You know, actually, no. It is actually in a chronic pain patient, depending on what we have. The reality of life is that if you live long enough, you will hurt, right? And so a lot of times it is not about getting rid of the pain. I tell patients this, I am an anesthesiologist. Every week I take away pain so that we can open up your belly and Dr. Clark can do surgery in there. Mm-hmm. There is zero pain during that process. I can take away your pain. But in order to take away your pain, you're going to be out with a tube coming out your mouth, laying in a place hooked up to monitors. That is not a life. What we actually want to do and what we do best is give you back a life that you want to live, maximize function. It's really about function. So if you have the same pain, but now you're able to interact with your wife, interact with your children, interact with your husband, go to work, be part of a useful society, have a life that is real and meaningful to you, versus I take away all the pains, but you're strung out on drugs and not interacting with anyone. Your life is horrible. You're constipated. Your skin itches. Mm-hmm. It's really this, which life would you choose? Most reasonable people would choose the former. So we actually focus on function and quality of life. This is why we talk about the biopsychosocial aspects of pain, not just the take care of biology, but what are we doing about the psychology and the social interaction? How do all these play? Because in dealing with pain, I always have to remember that I am dealing with a person who presents with pain and not with a pain. I can take away the pain, but I'll also take away the person. Mm-hmm. And there's a time for that. I believe there's a time for that. When you're having belly surgery, knee surgery, you know, in the operating room, your body is fully laid open. The surgeons are in there doing wonderful work. You don't need to be part of that process. You need to be out. You need to be comfortable. But after that's done, or after you're done shoveling the yard, or after the pain, now you need to be back in life and participating. So, you know, in talking to patients, people really do want to come back and be able to interact with the meaningful aspects of their life. So really, it's function.
Yeah, function. It's all about function.
Yeah.
Okay. We're going to take a quick mid-break here. You're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. After the short break, we'll continue our discussion on chronic and complex spine pain with Dr. Sola Alamakan and PA Ivy Weekland from Advanced Pain Centers of Alaska. Welcome back to Line 1, Your Health Connection. I'm your host, Dr. Justin Clark. I'm joined today for a discussion on chronic and complex spine pain with Dr. Sola Alamakan and PA Ivy Weekland from Advanced Pain Centers of Alaska. Of note, Ivy is a former employee of Anchorage Bariatrics about 4 years ago, so just wanted to make sure that was known. Okay, looks like we got a few calls coming in, and I want to give an opportunity here to talk first with Todd from Anchorage. Todd, welcome to Line 1.
Thanks so much, guys. What a great show. Hey, I'll try to keep it simple as I can. I'm 72 now, okay? I have had off and on low back pain, lumbosacral pain, since my mid-30s. Around then, I had x-ray diagnosis that was told by a very good physician that it was called facet syndrome, I don't know, some people say there's no such thing, and it was manageable, you know, off and on. In the past few years, it's been a lot worse. I had an incidental CT for another reason, showing a large amount of wear and tear arthritis in the spine. Here's my question. When I walk, if I can go a block without having to stop and bend over and stretch, and then I can recover, I'm doing well. But if I carry a weight like 20, 25 pounds, backpack, or like, you know, farmer carry, it really helps that discomfort and pain as I'm walking. I don't know, is this a stabilization effect? I'm not sure what to make of that and if I'm doing right or not by sort of using that.
Sure, it's an interesting question, Todd. Thank you for the posing this. I will pose this to our experts here. Dr. Lumpkin, any thoughts on why maybe some load would help decrease pain for Todd?
So what you're describing, Todd, is what we call claudication, which is where you have pain with activity, and usually that's going to be a blood flow issue, into what you're describing as a spine that already has a lot of pathology as it is. Incidentally, facet pathology is real. It is legitimate. It does show up on imaging. There is very specific treatments for it, which is something you'll find as an aside. There's always a lot of controversy about a lot of things, but it doesn't mean that there's any real questions about it. So just to let you know that what you're describing is legitimate. Now, it is interesting that adding weight decreases pain. That is way out of... That's different. Usually adding pain is going to make things more painful because you're adding stress on top of a pathology. I like your assumption about stabilizing. That makes some sense. Maybe, you know, what I would do if I saw you is I'd have you demonstrate how you carry, because it could be the way you carry is actually offsetting some strain offsetting some strain on your spine that you don't have when you're not carrying something? I think that I would have to see in order to not just make up an answer here.
Well, if it's working, then you don't have to.
If it's working, I'd say, hey, well, 25 pounds isn't bad. Keep on doing it. The more functional you stay, again, the better. Before I put you in physical, because I would see, I say, physical therapy, functional home exercise programs. Sounds like you found something that works. Yeah, I'd say keep it up, but don't now increase it to 100 pounds, right? 25 is good. 100 is four times better. It's probably not going to work. But I would think you're probably offloading things somehow.
Yeah, I would agree with you. Yeah, I think, you know, and just holding that weight, depending on how you're carrying it, is, you know, more than likely stabilizing some portion of the spine or, you know, offsetting that.
So a lot of times when we use backpacks, at least from, you know, from an experienced hiker, but most of the load is on my hips when I'm hiking, especially with a load. I wonder if that is changing anything with his posture.
It may be the carrying case is actually a support, right? The way technology has now, a lot of these supports do a really good, a lot of these bags are really good spine supports because they want to offload weight. So that may be the benefit that you're seeing. I'd have to see it, really.
And, you know, the weight may be contributing to the movement of the facet joints, where the more weight he's putting on, the more pressure there is on those joints, and they're not moving as much as they would if he didn't have the weight. Where, you know, with facet joints, if you know, the more movement, the more pain we can see with facet disease.
Huh. Good.
You know, it's interesting.
So I'll let you go, but hey, quick question. Weight training can be very beneficial, bones and muscles and stuff. Low back focused re-education type, you know, muscle training, would that be stabilizing as well?
So I'll caveat this answer with, it will only work if you're doing what I mean. And what I mean by that is, if you go online, I see so much stuff that is just utter nonsense. Yeah. And so, yes, if you're doing, this is why I like to do physical therapy. I love physical therapists. I love trained people who can at least get you and show you what to do and how to do it properly. Other quote unquote exercises in town, which I won't name, but usually involve a lot of aggressive, probably violent body motions, end up doing more damage than good. And a lot of them are touted as being the way to do it, and, you know, maximum benefit, et cetera. So if you're doing what you're describing, yeah, that is excellent. I support it. You get really good outcomes. But again, you got to be careful where you're getting your information and from whom.
Yeah.
There's a lot of stuff out there that is just destructive and harmful. And it looks good. It sounds good until you, but once you, with when you look at it with an educated eye, you're better able to decipher.
Yeah. Thank you for the call, Todd. We're going to take our next call. Cheryl's calling from Anchorage. Welcome to line one.
Thanks so much. Thanks for having me take my question. I have a question about lower, like I have lumbosacral back pain that is now, I think, would be considered chronic. And I have had RADS done. I've not had an MRI done. I don't have arthritic change. And it's interesting. I'm not painful up walking around, but at nighttime, it's really terrible. It will keep me awake. And I'm wondering just on your thoughts about nighttime lower back pain and some of the things that you have seen. I've got one of those knee pillows and it kind of helps, but hasn't been super, super beneficial. I'd like your thoughts on both, if you see that and what might help with it. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you, Cheryl, for your call. Let's see. Ivy, let's start with you on this one. Any thoughts on why pain might be worse in the lying position or maybe a mattress thing?
Yeah. So, you know, for some reason, a lot of our patients tend to flare up in the evenings and in the middle of the night. You know, nerve pain is known to flare in the evening and the night. Certain sleeping positions, you know, can put more pressure on the nerves, more pressure on the spine. One thing that we recommend is, getting proper mattress, proper pillow, to put less strain on the spine and the nerves. Did you mention that your nerve pain is running down your legs?
I don't know.
Did she say she had radicular pain?
No ridiculous.
Oh, okay. So sometimes we see with some of our patients with nerve pain, you know, depending on their pathology, we'll have a disc herniation that's putting pressure on nerves, and there are positions based off that that can really increase the pain at night. Dr. Lomgen, do you have?
The absence of arthritic changes is interesting. So often we'll hear patients will come in and go, they think I'm making it up because there's nothing on the x-ray. You have to remember, though, that arthritic changes are a chronic finding that happen over time. So even though there is injury and damage, it hasn't yet shown up that it's able to be identified on the imaging. You mentioned that you've had x-rays, but not MRIs. Often the MRIs would be better able to show the insidious injuries that haven't yet shown up. So the absence of the arthritic changes does not obviate the authenticity of your presentation. I think, and this is the time to actually start finding a treatment, and it may be something as easy as changing a mattress. Sometimes, the other reason I think we see a lot of pain at night is at night when you're laying in bed, there's no other distraction. So then you become so much more aware of the pain that you have built up over the day of activity that's now starting to show up. So we really like to look about not just the pain, but the biopsycho. What is the person? What are you dealing with? Where are you in life? What's your process? And see if, again, we can address the pain, but also address the impacts of the pain on you. Because if you're having this pain at night, you're probably not sleeping very well. So those are the things that we need to look at. When you don't sleep very well, the next day you're not going to do well. That night you're going to have a lot of pain. And then it just develops into this cycle. I'd start with the simple things, though. Changing mattresses, you know. Then get into a person who can actually look at you and see what you're dealing with. And maybe it's something as simple as physical therapy, which is nice and simple, but absolutely critical to get good outcomes with good physical therapists who understand what they're doing and how they're working the body. And I would not recommend ignoring it till it becomes quote unquote visible. I really think we start early, we start preemptively, and we hit it hard. And that way we actually end up doing less for you and set you up to go from this point with the right information and education to get you better long term.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you for the call, Cheryl. So piggybacking on that, Dr. Lomgen, we have another call coming in here in just a second. But why – so do you find imaging – I guess imaging can be a positive and a negative. I mean, it can it clarify things? Can it cloud the issue? What is your feeling on whether imaging can mislead or clarify a diagnosis? And I guess also – you know, why do some people have pain and have normal imaging?
Imaging is very useful. Imaging does not replace the clinician. I mean, imaging is like any other tool. You get good imaging with a good clinician, you get better outcomes. But imaging is like anything, depending on how it's used. We have what we call incidental omas, in which I'm sure Dr. Clark can talk about incidental omas as much as I can. This is where you find something, and it's this thing, and it's a big distraction, but it ends up being absolutely nothing. I mean, again, 8 billion people on Earth, we're not all identical, no matter what I tell you. So there'll be differences that are just the individual, of no issue. There's also the problem with overinterpretation. You see something on there, it looks like it could be the cause, and then you start chasing this. I have patients who get referred to me because they have a disc issue because, oh, they have a bulge on the disc. And I look at the image and I look at the patient and I write, yes, you have a disc bulge, but it has nothing to do with your presentation. They say, well, there's a disc bulge. Yes, it's there, but it's not your issue. And so when you can properly identify the cause, then imaging becomes useful. If you're overinterpreting things, it can be an issue. It can be a negative impact. Mismatch of symptoms. You have a presentation, you have an image, it shows something, but the symptoms you have is not what you're dealing with. Again, in those situations, imaging is of no real benefit. Imaging does become useful when it is when you're able to take it and correlate it with what you have. Sometimes, though, the image may look pristine, even though the patient has pathology. This is where good clinical acumen comes in. And also a good understanding. I'll give you an example. You have a patient come in with a radiculopathy, which is pain, say, going down from the back, going down the legs, commonly called sciatica. You get an x-ray you get an MRI, the discs look good, but there's a little tear, but it's not putting any pressure on a nerve. Usually, the radiculopathy is caused by the pressure on the nerve, and all the readings say there's no pressure. You go, well, there's nothing wrong. Yes, but if you understand that there's a tear, the contents of the disc itself are irritating to the nerve. So now, in the absence of pressure, the actual presence of the tear lets you understand the pathology you're dealing with. You're dealing more with a chemical irritation of a nerve as opposed to a pressure irritation of a nerve. That's why sometimes imaging may look good. And then we actually have the corollary, where imaging looks horrible. I had a patient, her spine was so bad that the spine, instead of being in a line, was stepped off. And I thought, how are you even walking? And she said, yeah, I've been that way for 20 years. I'm fine with it. That was probably, it struck me how significant her pathology was and how good she otherwise was. There's very bad spines and people are fully functional. So it's important, imperative, that we don't treat the image, but we use the image to treat the patient. And we always make sure that we're treating the patient. That's what we do. Did I answer the question?
You did. You did. Let's go to our next call. Amelia from Eagle River. Welcome to line one.
Hello. Thank you, doctors, for taking my question. 2.5 years ago, my husband was diagnosed with multiple myeloma, and they discovered lyatic lesions from the tip of his head to the top to his toes. But when he was diagnosed, he ended up with a broken sternum, 5 broken ribs, 4 compression fractures in his vertebrae, and others. Anyways, he shrunk 4 inches, and during his treatment, he went through a variant of opiates all the way up to and including methadone. None of them were effective because he's allergic to most opiates. He's currently on gabapentin, a low dosage of that, and he's accepting the pain, and it seems to be working, but as you know, multiple myeloma is incurable, and it will eventually come back, and I'm wondering if there's any recommendations for non-opiate painkillers that might be able to help my husband out in the future.
Oh, thanks, Amelia. It's a complex issue, and I'm sorry you have to deal with that. Dr. Lumpkin, any thoughts? I know we're a little limited here on the radio for direct medical advice, but in general, any thoughts for Amelia?
Amelia, my heart goes out to you. I can only imagine the stresses on the family and on your husband and on you dealing with this. Clearly, you're describing a very complex situation with your husband's presentation. And the lytic lesions cause a lot of bone pain, which is just a different kind of pain. Right. There's going to be neuropathic components and somatic components and nociceptive components. It's a complex pain. Without getting to specific treatments, which I can't do. I don't have enough information. But I think your actual question was, are there opioid medications coming on the market that could be helpful? I think at the end of the day, that was your question. And there are, but there are actually other medications now that are non-opioids, but that are sodium channel blockers, which are more like local anesthetics. And there's new medications coming out that I haven't even seen. But maybe worth pursuing, probably with your primary care or your oncologist, and seeing what's available out there. These are brand new meds. They're new. But in a patient who has tried all the opioids and hasn't benefited. Now, here's the other, there may be an option. Here's the other thing. You mentioned gabapentin. That is an excellent neuropathic medication. And even at low doses, you're having good responses from that. You may explore other medications within that medication group. We also tend to use other, pain being what it is, we manage pain not because with other classes of medication. So gabapentin is actually a seizure medicine. It's not a pain medicine. It's a seizure medicine. But it's an excellent pain medication because it manages pain. And so we also have other things that, other classes of meds that you could explore.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you for your call, Amelia. We have to take a quick break here. You're listening to Line One, Your Health Connection. After the short break, we'll continue our discussion on chronic and complex spine pain with Dr. Sola Olamican and PA Ivy Weekland from Advanced Pain Centers of Alaska. Welcome back to Line One, Your Health Connection. I'm your host, Dr. Justin Clark. I'm joined today for a discussion on chronic and complex spine pain with Dr. Sola Alamakan and PA Ivy Weekland from Advanced Pain Centers of Alaska. So we only have about 15 minutes left here, and I want to talk about a few different things, you know, more like interventional that you can offer patients. So I guess, you know, we've talked about, we can go into lifestyle if we have time, but physical therapy we've mentioned and medication management. But at some point, there are some devices that are available, whether implantable or wearable or injections. I want to give you the opportunity to discuss some of the medical and like minimally invasive treatments that are available out there for patients. So I will leave it at that. I'll let you start with where you think it's appropriate. But Dr. Alamakan, what are some of the, you know, treatment options for patients?
That's a good question. Depending on, so I always like to start this with, what am I treating? What is the diagnosis? And by that I mean, what is the cause of pain? What is the type of pain? There are three types of pain in broad categories. There's nociceptive pain, there's neuropathic pain, and there's somatic pain.
So define those for our listeners.
The nociceptive pain has more to do with tissue injury, muscles, etc. The neuropathic pain is going to be pain as a result of injury to a nerve. So the nociceptive pain, the tissue gets injured, the nerve carries the message. With neuropathic pain, the tissue is not injured, the nerve itself is injured. And then you have what we call the central pain, which is more as a result of either one of the first two or a combination of the first two. And then it causes an upregulation and a revving up of the pain pathway system, so that now you have an explosion of pain in the absence of actual tissue or nerve injury, but more as a subsequent of it. You can think of things like complex regional pain syndrome would be that third one. So now, understanding what I'm dealing with would now help to start determining what treatments would be used. For somatic pains or for nerve pains, we use the injections quite a bit. Usually it'll be some kind of a steroid, often with a local anesthetic. We also have the option to do things like PRP, which does healing. It actually doesn't do healing. What it does is it brings in so PRP, you take the blood, you spin it down, you put the platelets, and what the platelets do is they are usually the first step in the healing cascade, in the clotting cascade in the body. So what they do is they call in the body's own healing mechanism, and then they affect healing in injured tissues. So those would be the injections that we would do. Depending on nerve, say it was a nerve, then we can look at things like stimulators, and what they do is they would block the pain pathway. We also look at, again, local anesthetics and other components that block nerve upregulation. We could use certain clonidines and magnesium, and what these do is they calm and help reset the nerve pathway. So those are some of the injections that we do. We also could do, so you look at pain, we've talked about the body. Now, the pain will also affect the psychology of the individual, it can. So we actually use a lot of ancillary treatments. We'll look at counseling, we'll look at relationships to pain, we'll look at spirituality and we'll look at family, and we have relationships with other people in the community and other groups in the community who we can refer to or who we can liaison with as in consult to help deal with the patient after we have identified the presentation.
Yeah, so many different, you mean really you have to treat it from so many different areas. You know, we deal with that in our practice, mm-hmm. with managing, you know, not just someone's weight, but, you know, diet, exercise, lifestyle, yeah. sleep, mental yeah. health, everything that affects weight. Right. Your spine is no different than that. It's a multifactorial organ that requires a different sort of approach.
Yeah. you know, pain has an insidious way of being not just pain, not just my leg hurts or my back hurts, but it has a way of feeding and infecting into the life of the person that, that you're dealing with. It starts to affect their work life, their home life, their sleep, their mood, their identification of themselves. They go from being this person with all these activities to just being in pain. And so dealing with pain often has to do also with helping that person re-identify who they are, who they were, but more importantly, who they want to be. And that's, I think, where we at Advanced Pain, we try to be in tune with this so that we make sure that we don't just treat a patient with pain and send them out, and now they're like, okay, now what? What we want to do is make sure that we give the person a direction and a path to get back to who they want to be and back to a functional life.
Great. And I want to make sure we address an email that came in from Donna. Donna says that between her fourth and fifth lumbar, they are off by 11 millimeters. And she has been told that there's nothing to do for that except surgery. She does have pain that shoots down her legs when she is standing or walking. And she wanted to know if you had any potential recommendations.
That is a huge, that is a lot of, it's called a listhesis. It's what Donna is describing. Between the fourth and fifth, at 11 centimeters, it's concerning. I would want to know.
11 millimeters.
Sorry, 11 millimeters.
Centimeters would be really, really off.
At 11 millimeters, it is very concerning. That's 1.1 centimeters. I would want to see, usually after about five, we get concerned. After about 5 millimeters, we get concerned. At 11, she's over twice that. So I would want to see how much stability she has. Like, so it's present, but is it stable? That's really the question. If it's stable or not stable, then impact the next step. I would still recommend conversing with a few surgeons. And the reason you want a few surgeons is because you want to get, and by few, I mean like two. What you want to do is you want to get an informed idea and a good education on what you're dealing with. The risks, the possible complications, the possible outcomes. And that way, Donna is able to make an informed decision based on what she believes and where she stands, but informed with good good judgment. Fortunately, I have to say, we are blessed in Alaska to have a very good medical group, very good medical community here, which I think for a small city way out in the middle of nowhere, which, you know, way out in the tundra of Alaska, it's quite remarkable, the quality of the medical practice here. So there are very good surgeons, neurosurgeons, orthospine surgeons in town who I would say I want them to weigh in on this, because here's the issue. If this is unstable and the risk to Donna could be quite significant as far as ongoing function. So this is not something that I would want Donna to make a decision without having good consults and good advice on.
Great. Well, thank you, Donna. Hopefully that answers your question. So we have just a few minutes left here. So Ivy, when you're discussing with, you know, patients in the office, what barriers do people face when they are seeking long-term pain management? And where do you feel like, you know, the medical community could do a better job, or how you guys do it in the office?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, you know, I feel like a lot of our patients will come to us with chronic pain, and unfortunately, they've been dealing with this chronic pain for several years without appropriate treatment, or, you know, their primary care has thrown a few meds at them. And, you know, unfortunately, that's only managing taking the edge off when, you know, there's interventions that our pain clinic and other pain clinics are able to provide that. You know, I feel like a lot of patients had no idea that this was an actual option for them. And so really, our goal is to educate our medical community that we are here. We offer, you know, these interventions that can really help with pain and bring patients back to a functional life that's so much better for them. And, you know, we like to think of less is more in our practice. You know, if we can get our patients less medication and an improved function, that's goal. And through our interventional procedures like our epidurals or our radiofrequency ablations, we find that we can manage pain for months and months and sometimes years with patients not needing to be on the high levels of medication that they have been on. And so I think really just, you know, educating not only the medical community but also the patients that there are many options when it comes to pain management besides, you know, being on opiates or narcotics long term. And you know, I think just getting our patients in for a full examination and giving them all the different options is important.
Yeah, I think listening, right? I mean, we have this same problem in my office with obesity. It's a chronic disease, and then there's so much bias out there, and the people come into the office after you know, needing help for so long, but not wanting to come in for shame or that you know that this is all of their fault and things like that. So how do you manage that in your office? I mean, chronic pain is the same thing. It says, oh, here's just another pain patient, or it's all in your head. Like, how do you deal with you know, people that come in with that experience?
You speak of the very real and unfortunate stigma that is associated with things like obesity, like chronic pain, like mental health. And even though we see that succumbing to this stigma results in even worse outcomes, it's still something we have to deal with. You know, a lot of what we do is support. We listen, we support, we understand. The reality I find is patients, at least once or twice or three times a month, a patient will come in and go, I was supposed to have come in and I just didn't want to come in because I don't want to be a pain patient. I don't want to be on pain pills. And they leave the clinic understanding that we don't want you to be that pain patient you don't want to be either. We're not actually trying to put you on meds that don't work. We're not trying to rush you into getting some painful procedure. Mm-hmm. There are things that we can do that when you look at the person and you look at their whole complexity, there's a lot of interventions that will get patients to where they need to be, which is our goal. So anyone who doesn't want those things that they fear would do well, because we don't want those things for them either. It's understanding where the patient is coming from, understanding their concerns, understanding that someone somewhere has often told them that it's all in their head, or they're drug seeking, or they're crazy, or they shouldn't be having these because everything looks fine. Those are real things that people deal with.
Yeah.
And getting to people who understand how to manage it is the way to go. I think of us, you know, I think of us as, and actually, this is my idea. I heard this in training and it just stuck with me. The pain medicine, a good pain medicine clinic, a pain management clinic, is like the cardiologist. When you have chest pain, you don't go to a cardiac surgeon for a quadruple bypass. You go to a cardiologist who will stratify where you are, manage you conservatively, and then, if necessary, send you to a cardiac surgeon. The surgeons appreciate this because the last thing a surgeon wants to do is take the time to see you and then have to send you back to me, right? So working in conjunction, we're better able to work with the team and it's so much smoother when they come to us. We get things optimized and then we triage to where they need to be.
Mm. Last 10 seconds or so, what is your or Advanced Pain Centers of Alaska? Is there a phone number or anything you'd want to get across to patients?
We're on Abbott, behind the Capital One building.
Yep, GCI building.
Behind GCI building, beside that, the Credit Union One.
Yeah.
907-278-2741. And we will give hope and we will help you with the restoration function and improve the function and quality of life.
Thank you. Special thanks to our guests for being with us today, Dr. Sola Alamakin and PA Ivy Weekland from Advanced Pain Centers of Alaska.
Thank you.
Thanks to our audio engineer, Chris Hyde, and our producer, Rachel Cassandra. You can find more information on this and previous programs on our website at alaskapublic.org. This program will be available on demand through Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Amazon Music. Let us know your thoughts or suggestions by emailing us at line1@alaskapublic.org. This has been Line One, Your Health Connection. I'm your host, Dr. Justin Clark. Stay healthy, Alaska.
Line One is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters. Learn more about Line One and listen online at alaskapublic.org. This is Alaska Public Media.